Welcome to the Deep End by On Deck, a podcast for visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozloff. Let's dive in.
We've known for a while now that there are animals that age very differently than we do. So there's no sort of hard limit on lifespan that's, you know, in biology, right? That's like hard-coded into the genome. There are other mammals like the bowhead whale that live well into their 200s. There are trees that live into their thousands. I think the Greenland shark lives into the 400s, right? So there's all these really interesting examples in biology. And we've only recently begun to appreciate, I would say, how to intervene. So we've known that lifespan is malleable, but exactly what to do about it, I would say, is more recent.
Deep End, we're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in depth into ideas that inspire people to build. I'll be your guide as we explore possible futures of internet communities, creator tools, climate tech, longevity, and much, much more. There are no experts in uncharted territory, only pioneers. The Deep End invites these trailblazers to turn their experiences into the knowledge and ideas that others need to start their own founder odysseys. Joining me this week in the Deep End is Dr. Kristen Fortney, CEO and co-founder of BioAge, a company working to slow aging and chronic disease. Figuring out how to live longer is an age-old problem. For as long as humans have studied medicine, we have tried to learn which remedies, habits, and environments best position us to have a chance at a long life. Recent developments in the last few decades have, for the first time in human history, opened up the door for serious progress into understanding how humans and animals age. Last season, we had Celine on the show to talk about the work that her team is doing to improve the health of dogs. Now, Kristen joins us to give an overview of the aging field. She also shares how BioAge is using machine learning to develop a pipeline of therapeutic assets that increase health span and lifespan. Aging may be the core cause of many of the cancers and chronic diseases that wind up killing us. If we can leverage AI to help identify flawed genes, we can make lifespan truly malleable. There are plenty of exciting discussions here, including what the differences are between health span and lifespan, what it would take for the healthcare industry and regulatory bodies to approve anti-aging drugs, how we might otherwise learn how to live as long as 200-year-old whales or 1,000-year-old trees. Kristen Fortney, welcome to The Deep End.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's interesting. Typically, I begin a podcast by asking what problem you're solving or working to address, and you are probably focused on a problem, aging-related diseases, that is probably the one that has probably been most seen as a problem for most, if not all, of human history. So I just love to start with getting you to describe what the problem in the aging longevity category looks like in the 21st century.
Yeah, for sure. So it is a problem, an age-old problem, as you say. It's been around with us for centuries. What is new in the 21st century is that the science is ready to be translated. So we finally, for the first time, really understand how humans and other animals age and how we might intervene to help them live healthier longer. And that's all very recent. That's really all in the past two or three decades only that we've gotten to this point.
It'd be great to hear, up until those past two or three decades, what was the most scientifically valid consensus on why we aged until right before that period? We could obviously put aside various degrees of quackery. What was the most legitimate explanation for these questions, and how did it then change?
Well, I think we understood at a very general level, right? Like there's wear and tear, just like with, a car or any kind of physical object, right? There's these forces of entropy as you get older. And similarly, people have understood, since we've understood evolution, that selective pressure decreases after reproductive age. So nature doesn't really select for you to live a lot longer after you've produced children. And at the same time, we've known for a while now that there are animals that age very differently than we do. So there's no sort of hard limit on lifespan that's, in biology, right? That's like hard-coded into the genome. There are other mammals like the bowhead whale that live well into their 200s. There are trees that live into their thousands. I think the Greenland shark lives into the 400s, right? So there's all these really interesting examples in biology. And we've only recently begun to appreciate, I would say, how to intervene. So we've known that lifespan is malleable, but exactly what to do about it, I would say, is more recent.
What you're saying around lifespan being malleable is interesting because it doesn't seem to be that novel of a point upon first hearing it. So for example, a dog is going to live for 8 to 15 years. Humans can live, you know, to an average of something in the 70s. There doesn't seem to, so when you're saying how we age differently, what is that, Rick Ruimi, when you're putting it that way?
Well, we do share a common ancestor with a dog and with a mouse that lives only for a couple of years, right? So that all these different lifespans are compatible with evolution. But even if you restrict yourself and look only at humans, right, you see a huge diversity. There are people who over and over again make it to the age of 115, and oftentimes with still, and these people often too have good physical functioning, good mental functioning, well into their 100s. So that's something that should be really close and really more accessible for modern science, right? It might be a lot harder to figure out how a bowhead whale is living to 200 or how a tree is living to 1,000 and actually turn that into a useful drug or intervention for a human. But what's lower hanging fruit is looking at these people who are already aging so well and so successfully. One of my favorite examples, Lila Denmark, was a practicing pediatrician until the age of 104. So she retired 40 years later, you know, than the average person. That means her working life is really twice as long, you know, as most people's, right? Which is amazing. Because to still be a practicing doctor, you still have to be mentally there. You still have to be physically there and very independent. So we know that that sort of healthy aging is compatible with human biology without sort of veering too far off of our path. Yeah.
And we'll get into what you're doing at BioAge in a second, but the two preceding questions. One, so when we're thinking of these examples of folks who are living into their hundreds, 110s maybe, how much of that is coming down to, or how much of the takeaway from that is there are scientific interventions or developments that we can advance, and how much of it is, well, people, let's say in Japan, are living a healthier lifestyle. Therefore, the way to get us to higher average age amount, average lifespan would be through lifestyle choices and design. What's the distinction there?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for a given genotype, you can optimize your environment, your diet, your exercise, and do as well as you can. But a lot of these, I think, extreme longevity phenotypes are fairly heritable. So there is a really important genetic component as well.
What is the reason why different phenotypes would have different, why would there even be diverged? Like, wouldn't everyone, but we're really pushing my high school biology here, but evolutionarily speaking, wouldn't everyone effectively select for extended lifespan? Like, why would this be divergent in that way?
Well, evolutionarily speaking, I guess there's sort of, you know, 8 billion experiments going on on the planet with a lot of variation across various traits that might be, you know, advantageous in certain environments and deleterious in other ones. And usually shorter lifespans go along with sort of earlier stage reproduction. You see that with a lot of animal species that sort of have lots of children young, also have very short lifespans. So, and there, you can think there's a cost there too, right? Like if you're going to wait around until, you know, your 50s or your 60s to have children, that's got to be 50 or 60 years where you don't die because of predators or other extrinsic mortality, right? So actually, in an environment where there aren't a lot of sources of, they call it extrinsic mortality, right? When it's something from the outside that comes and kills you as opposed to a process in your body, then over time, actually, that does select for a longer lifespan. And that probably has happened and contributed to some extent to our lifespans.
And then the last question before we get into the company, what attracted you to the longevity space in the first place on a personal level? What's interesting is that whenever someone tends to be in this category, there's usually some type of reason or something. It's not as if you picked up, you know, your business idea process and said, I'm going to do a SaaS business. No, there's something like deeper here. Obviously, you have a PhD, but I would just love to hear about how you're coming into this.
Sure. There's no sort of like one, you know, pivotal event in my life history, but I've been very interested in aging in the space and the science since I was a teenager. and following the progress there, and was just always really excited by the potentials. Because again, we've made great strides as a field in just the past two or three decades, and there is a growing list of things that you can do to a mouse, you know, interventions like genetic mutation, or you give them a therapy, some kind of drug, and they live substantially longer and healthier. So they're not just, you know, living longer, but pretty much any tissue you look at, you know, whether it's their brains or their muscles, it's all better, right? They look healthier, they run better on their wheels for longer. It's sort of across the board good. And if we could translate those discoveries to humans, that could add, you know, 10 to 20 years of healthy life. And I think a lot of medicine today is really focused on extending sick life, and not even that well, right? Like today in the US, I think the average lifespan is in the low 80s, but the average health span is only in the low 60s. That's the age at which you get your first age-related disease. They pile up over time. It's both, you know, the most expensive period of your life, and also just not very good in terms of quality of life either, right? And what you see in these animals where you're extending their health span, they're actually also spending a smaller proportion of their life being sick. So it's just the idea that this could be translated to people was always very motivating for me personally. And, you know, it's the right time for that now.
It's interesting that you say there isn't this big epic moment where you got into longevity, because it reminds me of just the anecdote you hear whenever Peter Thiel comes up, which is, you know, when Peter Thiel was young, his father told him that the cow died, and he's like, "Well, cow dies, death." So to that point, and Peter's obviously funded longevity related startups. But how, when you're meeting investors, employees, etc., how do you tell the story of longevity and why this is not only just an exciting space intellectually, but like actually there is a process that's culminated 20 or 30 years of research that's created an opportunity for folks?
Yeah, sure. So you can look at just the history of the field, and it's really exciting. Like, I think until about, you know, maybe the early 1990s, everyone thought that aging is just so complicated. There are so many different things that are going wrong. I mean, precisely because evolution isn't selecting for longer lifespans, right? So there's just like a million things that are independent that are going wrong. So how could you possibly hope to do a simple thing and have a dramatic impact, right? Like, isn't that kind of a lost cause? And so it was even, I would say, like considered a scientific backwater. There weren't a lot of academics in the field. And, you know, what I think is underappreciated today is that even today, aging is still a small field in science. Like, it's a new science. Any major research university you go to, there will be, you know, dozens of people studying cancer biology and a handful, you know, at best that work on aging, even though in a lot of ways it's a lot more complicated. Anyway, so that's sort of the history of the field. It was not getting a lot of scientific attention. That changed in the early 1990s with some now very famous work. Cynthia Kenyon, Gary Revkin, and others showed that you could take a roundworm, C. elegans, that usually lives 2 weeks, remove one gene, and double its lifespan. And that was just amazing to people, right? Like, that's a huge effect from a tiny, tiny change. And you know, really surprised a lot of people. It was not what was expected at all. And then in the 1990s, you see a lot of people inspired by this discovery. So people who were invertebrate biologists who were experts at manipulating genes in, you know, worms and flies and yeasts, come into the aging field and use these toolkits that they built. And they actually did experiments like, let's try knocking down every single gene in the genome of the worm one at a time and see what it does to lifespan. And you can do that because it's only a 2-week experiment every time, or, you know, a 4-week experiment if you double their lifespan, but still quite short, and start to make lists of things that could modulate the lifespan. And what we really learned in the 1990s is that there are hundreds of things that can modulate the lifespan. And again, this is kind of what you would expect, because we are not, you know, worms are not, and neither are humans, like, optimized for longevity in any way. So there's actually a lot of modifications you could make that would make them live longer, make them live healthier longer. And it was really only in the 2000s when people started to look at lots of different interventions, both genetic as well as, you know, drug therapy interventions in mice. And it is a lot more challenging to go into mice, right? Because mice live 4 years, like 4 years. If you're a PhD student, you don't want to double the mouse's lifespan. You're going to be in the lab for a long time. And, you know, you require a lot more animals, a lot more time. So really only a few dozen things have been tried so far, which is another important point. Like, I think the National Cancer Institute in the last couple decades has put over 10,000, you know, drugs into mice to see if it helps cure mouse cancer. But really, we've only investigated a few dozen things for aging because it's a hard experiment to run. But nevertheless, some things work, right? Like rapamycin is a famous example. Parabiosis, this blood exchange is another famous example. There's a growing list of things that you can do to these animals that should be translational to us too, because we're getting closer now. We're looking at a mammal, and something that works in a mammal like a mouse is more likely to work in a human like us. So as I said, it's like very, very brand new. Yeah.
And something I'm wondering about as you're describing this is, could you further delineate the difference between lifespan and health span when it comes to this? Because you said specifically, this is a field that doesn't have quite as much of the heft in terms of persons studying it. But when you're describing health span, you're describing the 60s, 70s, 80s period. It seems like the number, the amount of diseases, the amount of obvious healthcare spend that's spent there, the amount of just like personal suffering that goes in would actually attract a lot of folks. So when you're describing the lack of engagement with the field, like, is that more towards the lifespan part, or is it towards the health span part, or is there not really a distinction?
So yeah, the secret is that there's not really a distinction. I think that you know, the field can get a bad rap if you say that, oh, I'm working on, you know, extending lifespan, and someone will, a lot of people will think, oh my gosh, that just means that I'm going to be, you know, in the hospital hooked up to 20 machines for like another decade. That's awful. And, you know, and so there's this idea that, you know, you don't want to study lifespan separately from health span. Like, of course you don't, right? The thing though, is that in reality, it's very difficult to have the one without the other, right? Like imagine you have a drug that, you know, like it's actually like way, way harder to make an animal live longer when it's incredibly frail. Because to be frail, to have poor health, basically means that it's, you know, about to die, right? So I think it's an important point that isn't always obvious, but the two go hand in hand, right? If you are going to curing disease, if you are extending life, you are also extending health. So there are people that work on individual diseases, and maybe that's what you were getting at as well, right? And what the promise of aging is, and really sort of looking at these diseases through the lens of aging, like I think it's underappreciated that most of these diseases happen in an aged context, right? Like Alzheimer's does not happen to a 20-year-old. Cancer usually doesn't happen to a 20-year-old. They all rise exponentially with age. And by studying aging, we're going to find novel targets that matter for multiple of these diseases.
Something that's interesting whenever I speak to experts in your field is that, at least as an outsider, it seems as if the rhetorical ambitions have really been dialed back over 20, 30 years during this period. So if you ask people, especially when it comes to Silicon Valley, hey, like, tell me about aging, there's, you know, talking about, you know, freezing heads and reviving people, the word immortality gets colloquially thrown around. But obviously, like, that's nothing, like you said, like the ambition is 20 years of life. So there's nothing like truly, truly, truly game changing. If we could live in a world where the US looks much more like Japan, that'd obviously be a game changing win when it comes to those health outcomes. So can you just speak as a founder, frankly, about how like the public perception relative to the field's ambitions, how this dynamic actually plays out?
Right now, this is biotechnology, right? So adding 10 years or 20 years to healthy lifespan, like, is amazing, right? Like, if you are in the cancer field, you know, you can say, you know, my goal is to cure cancer, mm-hmm. you know? And but do you know, if cancer were cured, do you know how many years that would actually add to lifespan overall?
Like three?
Yeah, that's right. Three or four. So not many, right?
Man, that's like, a good guess. The math, yeah. There is, I was like, what's a number which would probably mean something, but would also still marginally, not, it's probably three. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. No, a lot of people guess like 20 or 30, yeah. Right? So you're much closer there, right? But even if we cure cancer altogether, that's really only adding 3 to 4 years to the average lifespan. And again, that's because most cancers happen to older people. And if it's not cancer, then it's heart disease or Alzheimer's or something else. So, I mean, you might, you know, I don't know. To me, that sounds incredibly ambitious to increase life by 10 or 20 years. I mean, as we discussed earlier, right, there is no sort of hard limit, like, imposed by biology, really. There's no sort of upper bound. And you could imagine in the future that maybe humans do have an 1,000-year lifespan. It's just going to be a much, much longer road with a lot of science that we don't know today. I frankly think that adding 10 to 20 years by is going to be fairly straightforward.
So let's actually talk about BioAge. So you come from an academic background, obviously. Can you speak to what drove you, or what attracted you to the biotechnology side of things as opposed to the research side? There's probably much more connection between these two fields than I'm rhetorically making it sound like here, but we'd just love to hear like that part of the story and how your experience applies to other researchers, people who thought their main path was academic in nature but could see an alternative. How you think about all that?
I've always been motivated by translating science. I've never been sort of a, you know, science for science's sake, because it's fun. You know, it's just really to sort of improve human lives, improve the human experience, develop medicines. That's always been the motivation for me. And for me, the transition, I guess I realized, you know, slowly over time that the place to do that was not in academia. As a professor, you know, it's a very different kind of set of incentives and motivation there, but actually in the context of a biotech company where you can start with your research, but then follow it through to actually develop a drug, take it to the clinical trials and hopefully get it approved. Yeah.
I'd love for you to describe the ecosystem that you're looking at. So we've described two of the players. You obviously have universities and research labs. You have companies, but there's also, at least in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, broader regulatory structure. Can you describe how these various parts fit together? And as you've transitioned from academia to spending the last multiple years building a company, how you've actually seen these various parts not sync up well, and whether there's opportunity for approaching them in different ways?
There's a lot of opportunity. Like, I think especially in the aging field, because it is new science, the bottleneck is all around translating that science. So I think there are a lot of discoveries that are ready to be turned into medicines, but not enough people making that happen. I think that's finally starting to change. I've been in the aging field, you know, I got my PhD in 2012, so it's been a while. And I think for the first time, like this year, I can say that there are a number of clinical trials starting that are testing, you know, basic mechanisms of aging in important human diseases. And behind those, I think there are now several dozen startups that are trying to translate some of these basic ideas from aging biology. So it's finally starting to bear fruit, but I feel like that's really still the bottleneck, that there's a lot of very interesting science that isn't being translated yet. And, you know, I think that's been more true for aging than for particular diseases like cancer, diabetes. And part of that is just because there has to be like a first drug, right? Like you mm-hmm. mentioned some of the other stakeholders like the FDA or even like biotech investors, right? Like there has to be a first drug that is an aging drug that is approved that, you know, payers pay for, that improves functional outcomes and, you know, saves money for the healthcare system. That is an example, you know, and I think once the first aging drug gets approved and goes to market, that'll be a real watershed moment for the field and help drive innovation for lots of the other mechanisms that are going to work.
I know that everyone hates predictions, so I'm not literally asking you to tell me when that drug will happen, but could you give a general sense? Because let me take a step back. It's interesting to me that you're talking about these different startups. Why are startups equipped to this process versus going to work in a division of a traditional pharmaceutical drug company? Like, what is it unique about startups that can fill the void that folks are seeing here?
I mean, to be fair, nowadays a lot of approved drugs, and potentially the majority, but you know, I'd have to look that up. No matter what the area are, come from small companies, come from biotech, right? So large pharma buys a lot of its innovation or partners with smaller companies. So I don't think aging is necessarily unique in that sense. Yeah.
So then, when you're talking about the fact that this is, it's interesting to me because, you know, we're talking about startups here. And there's a regulatory process, there's deep research to be done. What does the best case scenario, if you're speaking to an investor, look like? Is it that a big pharma company acquires you? Is someone going public? How does this process tend to work when it comes to the actual investment side?
Well, the very best upside scenario is for a small biotech company to one day become a large pharma. Yeah. there haven't been, you know, many of those in recent years, but there's no reason why not. And if you're looking at, I mean, the opportunity for an aging drug is really enormous, right? Because one example that I like to cite frequently is a drug like a statin, which is basically prescribed today like an aging drug, right? Like if you're over 40, you have some risk biomarkers, you get a statin. So it's basically prescribed as a function of your age. It was first approved for an orphan disease, hypercholesterolemia, now decades ago, right? And they sort of learned over time that it actually had broader applicability and sort of widened the indication label. And of course, that's one of the most profitable drugs ever because it's relevant to such a huge subset of the population. And that's frankly going to be true for any aging drug that works.
I don't want to make any assumptions, but I get the sense from your accent that you are Canadian. So I'll take that as a yes. I'm curious.
Oh yes, very Canadian. I'm curious if I dropped too many A's there. There were two or three.
It was the aboot actually that got you. What I'm wondering is because so much of this research process is like obviously intersecting with regulation. How does the American system compare to the Canadian system? Like, is there such thing as there being, this is just, I'm just thinking about this because there's obviously this big conversation around what city should you launch a startup in? What market actually makes the most sense? And if I'm thinking about regulation when it comes to pharmaceuticals and longevity, it seems like that question is the most valid when it actually comes to your space. So what drives a location or an ecosystem that makes the most sense to engage in this sort of research and development?
Yeah, that's a great question from a regulatory perspective, because, you know, for example, right, like some of the drugs that we're working on at BioAge, we think ultimately might be drugs for frailty. So the fact that your physical function gets worse as you get older, your physical performance gets worse, you don't walk as fast as you used to. We think that, you know, there are mechanisms that could address that and make that better. The thing is, that's not a real disease indication, not in the US, but not elsewhere either. That said, the EMA, which is sort of Europe's version of the FDA and Japan as well, are very, very interested in this area. And the FDA is not yet. The fact that there's socialized healthcare seems to motivate different perspectives on some of these diseases. So some of these drugs you might want to, you know, get approved in Europe first and then take the data back to the FDA and go there afterward.
What's interesting to me is that, you know, you're running the company, you have an academic background, you're describing regulatory processes. What is the real toolkit for a founder leader in your space in terms of actually intersecting with all this? Are you primarily focused on research? Are you working more as an operator? Are you interfacing with regulatory agencies? What does that mix tend to ideally look like from your perspective?
I mean, honestly, it changes every year. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, at BioAge, we became a clinical stage company just over a year ago, right in the middle of the pandemic. So that's when I hired our chief medical officer, the rest of our clinical team. And for me, the last year has really been learning all that from scratch because I've never been part of a clinical trial before. It's very different from what you get as an academic background, you know. And of course, there'll be even greater challenges as we advance through the clinic. And then, you know, commercialization, hopefully, will be a problem we'd love to have in a couple of years. So honestly, you know, my day job has changed tremendously from year to year based on whatever new area we're going into, right? Like, I think right now we have three clinical programs. From, you know, from zero a year and a half before. So our most important task as a company is to show that we can execute on the clinical side. So that's something that I'm, you know, very closely involved with currently. But in terms of other work, yes, I'd still love to have my fingers in the science. That's my training as well. But yeah, mostly an operator, right? So I spent a lot of my time hiring people who knew how to do all these different pieces much better than I do.
You know, it's interesting. You said, you know, you're at the clinical stage now. What when you're looking at a company in your space, what does that preclinical stage look like? Is it purely conducting research? Is the money that you raised and are spending, is it focused on there? Like, what does that pre-process look like?
Well, if a preclinical company is, you're basically deciding what you're going to advance to the clinic, right? So it's, what do I have to do? What experiments do I have to do to believe that my mechanism works, you know, and in what indication? And also, like, is it a drug, right? Can I manufacture it? Is it safe? Like, sort of checking all those boxes on the way to the clinic. Yeah.
And I realize I've had a terrible set of mispractice as a podcast host. Can you actually describe what BioAge does beyond obviously working in the, because this is a podcast where we're talking about a product category, but also like hearing what you actually do, what is unique about your approach? I'm curious how the company has changed over this period from inception to actually us talking now. We'd love to just hear all of that.
Yeah, definitely. Sure. So our mission is really to advance a portfolio of different therapies that address aging. And I want us to make a lot of different bets. As we were discussing earlier, aging is a very new field, right? Like not a lot of hypotheses have been tried in a clinical setting. You know, like let's try modifying this pathway and seeing if it improves this aging-related disease. That's basically not been done. And what that means to me, you know, is that frankly, there's going to be a lot of low-hanging fruit. I told you before that, you know, hundreds of genes work in worms, right? I think there's going to be dozens of pathways that work in humans. And we want to, you know, try as many of those in parallel as we can. Part of our guiding principle too is that, you know, it's risky to be in the clinic. You can be surprised, you know, you can do everything right in the world and still get surprised in the clinic with, you know, your drug isn't safe or it does something very different in a human compared to what you saw it do in a mouse. So we want to have a lot of sort of uncorrelated bets where we can like see if it's working early and with human data and use that to sort of inform for further clinical discovery. So that's sort of one part of what we're doing. But the other major thing to know is that where our hypotheses are coming from. And they're all coming from human data. And part of this is what we touched on earlier, right? Like there are 8 billion human experiments going on around us. And I think that the lowest hanging fruit is going to be to copy what is already working, right? Like what is different about those humans who live to be 100 and are aging successfully at a molecular level? Like what's going on in their bodies? And how can we mimic that with a therapy or a drug to make us all live healthier longer? Because aging is a new space, it's risky, right? So we want to start with what we think has the highest probability of success and will be the easiest to figure out. So we've invested a lot in building the right human molecular aging data sets. We've partnered with some pretty special biobanks. Like biobanking is all the rage now. Everybody is doing it. But
can you explain what that
really
what,
to study
what,
aging?
What does that mean?
Sorry?
What is a biobank?
Oh, there's like Google Baseline. There's all these services now that will collect samples from healthy people longitudinally, right? And like all these other metrics, like your wearables and, you know, all these other complex metrics and track them over time to correlate them to health. And because humans really age over decades, right? It doesn't happen overnight. You really need molecular data that span decades to understand how humans age. So even though biobanks are popular today, you would need to wait, you know, I think 50 years to see how people went from middle-aged onwards to understand the whole, you know, second half of their lives. So what we do at BioAge is we partner with some biobanks that started collecting samples 50 years ago from healthy people. There are not many of those because that's a hard thing to do, right? It was not a popular thing then. And, you know, they're really, you know, forward thinking in a way, right? Because they have these samples stored from healthy people and that have been saved for decades under the assumption that, you know, in the future, there would be better modalities to go into those samples and figure out what was going on. And that's very true today, right? Like right now, we can go into a blood sample and do a full proteome, look at 7,000 proteins, look at thousands of metabolites, look at tens of thousands of RNA transcripts. None of those were available, like not remotely, 50 years ago. So we go into these longitudinal samples and we ask a bunch of questions of the data. Like these kinds of molecular data sets over time are good for a lot of different analyses, but we can do things like say, you know, what pathways are changing as you get older? But even more interestingly, like what's different about those 50-year-olds who go on to live 90 plus in great health, like from the rest of us at a molecular level? And what's sort of the map of those differences? And what we're doing at BioAge is we're betting, you know, on those mechanisms. We're advancing clinical stage drugs that target these pathways that are important for human aging in our data sets. I should mention too, you know, we also we don't just go directly from data to the clinic. We have thousands of old mice that we evaluate our drugs in. And we're also focused specifically, another important part about the company, on immune aging and muscle aging, which are really sort of fundamental aspects of aging that happen to everybody, that are common across species as well.
You know, I'm glad you brought up wearables, because as we're nearing the end here, we need to get to the news you can use part here. So I'm asking you to put on your PhD hat here. Not that it's not always on, but really focused there. How should consumers think about, let me actually just put it this way. I am about to turn 30, and I feel like a switch flipped, and all of a sudden there are all these products, there's all these supplements, there's all these, like, there's five different wearables I could hypothetically wear right now, and they wouldn't actually contradict each other. Just because, like you said, people are increasingly focused and excited on this space, but it's meant there's just a lot of noise. And frankly, most of us, myself included, don't actually have the toolkit to evaluate these things. So how should we as consumers just think about that space here, now that it's quote unquote cool and accessible to do this type of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, my answers to that are mostly going to be boring ones, which is that.
That's the secret.
I mean, you know, yeah, it's not something where you can really over optimize. I think people over optimize, right? With too many sort of parameters of their, or, you know, over optimize in the sense that they think they're optimizing it, but it's actually like not necessarily going to help, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what is still true today is for the most part what we knew a couple decades ago, which is, you know, moderate exercise, you know, something like a Mediterranean diet. These are the things that have the best evidence, and lots of coffee. That's maybe the one.
Lots of
that's a bit, you know.
Lots of coffee.
Lots of coffee. Yeah, it's funny that I call it, you know, the underappreciated longevity supplement. People consider it unhealthy for some reason, but there have been all these great, like so many retrospective analyses, like really good ones showing that the more coffee you drink on a daily basis, up to 5 or 6 cups per day, the lower your all-cause mortality. And it's very reproducible. So lots of coffee. That's a good one. The one I would say newish discovery is more around something like intermittent fasting. There is pretty good evidence in animals and shorter term evidence in humans that if you have a longer period of, you know, not eating, like if you skip breakfast or even skip, you know, breakfast and lunch some days, that can be good for you.
You know, I'm so glad there isn't video on this episode, speaking to the audience here, but you all are missing the look of actual surprise in my face when Kristen said coffee, because I think that goes to what I was just speaking about, because there are so many whiplashes of conventional wisdom. And I feel like a signal that's going out there is that lots of stimulants like caffeine, coffee are not good for you. So it's refreshing to hear I can maintain the 4 to 5 a day bit here. So two last bigger questions. So one, to your point around past 2 decades, a lot of energy in the space. As you said, there's not that many hypotheses that have been tested, but what were some initially promising avenues that to some degree we know just don't work? What is something I read in the New Yorker 10 years ago that's just almost certainly outdated? I think that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, most of those still haven't been tried, right? Like there's a cousin of intermittent fasting, which I think a lot of people are interested in, called calorie restriction, which is just eating less on a daily basis. And that didn't pan out so well when they looked at primates. And the limited data we have on humans doesn't look so promising either. For that matter, even in mice, you know, I think BLK6 mice, which is the most common lab strain, it helps them out, but lots of other mice, it actually makes them live shorter. So that's one that didn't pan out very well.
At a scientific level, what's the difference between calorie restriction and intermittent fasting?
Yeah, so you're often not, like, calorie restriction is, I think, pretty severe reduction in calories. Okay. So it's like overall, you're like eating 30 to 40% fewer calories than normal. So these animals are very, very thin, you know. Intermittent fasting, you might have nearly the same amount of calories on a daily basis, but they're just compressed into a shorter time window. And there seems to be, you know, beneficial biological processes around autophagy that get activated, sort of cleaning of the cells. I mean, I think that's still, frankly, being documented exactly how it works. But it seems to work pretty well. Yeah.
And for the last question here, obviously OnDeck is running our longevity fellowship. So this is the part where I would just love for you to hear the different avenues that folks who are interested in this space, like what are the spaces that they should be pursuing? Should folks still, and not mean everyone, but is the right path still to go get your PhD and then pivot out? Is there a workaround there? There doesn't seem to be an equivalent of just starting a company and not going to college or dropping out. How do you think about pathways in, pivots out, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I don't think that's necessary anymore, right? If you want to found a biotech, even like I think, you know, there's a broad, even outside of aging, there's a broader move around more founder-led biotechnology companies. I think that in the last few years, biotech founders have been people who are more sort of serial CEOs with, you know, pharma backgrounds, right? And we're starting to see more support for non-traditional founders, which might be like a great entrepreneur from another space, right? Like maybe from tech. Or it could be someone, you know, fresh out of academia. Or so I honestly think there's a lot of different avenues. Like, of course, you need to deeply understand the science or work with someone you trust who does. because that's frankly the hardest thing, figuring out what's real and what's worth betting on versus what's not. I think the aging field has that problem a little bit more than certain other spaces. But I do think that there's a lot of opportunity for people who want to get involved. Yeah.
Well, Kristen, this has been really great. Really, once again, pushed my bio from high school. I hope no one's disappointed in me back home, but really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for joining us on The Deep End.
Yeah, thanks, Marshall.
Thanks for joining us in The Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.